The UN is there to create a more equal world. And so that's what this convention is about, is how do we make our tax world financially more equal?
Welcome to Multilateralism Unpacked, the podcast of United Nations University Center for Policy Research. I'm Jack Dorrell, Head of Communications at UNU CPR. Today we're looking at something that can seem highly technical, but has profound implications for how countries finance their development: international taxation. This week at the UN, governments are negotiating a new framework convention on international tax cooperation, an effort that could reshape how international tax rules are made and how taxing rights are distributed between countries. But these negotiations are also part of a much bigger conversation about debt, inequality, and fiscal space. For many developing countries, the question is not simply how much they spend or borrow, but how much revenue they are able to raise, and whether the international financial system properly recognizes the assets and economic value they possess. To unpack all this, I'm joined by Professor Atiyah Waris, Senior Fellow at UNU CPR, Professor of Fiscal Law at the University of Nairobi, and a UN independent expert on foreign debt, international financial obligations, and human rights. Atiyah has contributed directly to the UN tax convention process, including through recommendations on taxing rights, inequality, wealth, and dispute resolution. Atiyah, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with the negotiations around the framework convention. For someone who hasn't been following this process very closely, what is the UN trying to achieve with a framework convention on international tax cooperation, and why does it matter?
So we have almost 200 countries across the world, and every country has a different tax system. So if I'm working in one country, but I'm a citizen of another country, sometimes I might have to pay tax in the country I work in, and also in the country of my nationality. And that's just one example. So if you think about these 200 countries, all with very different tax systems, there are cases where instead of maybe paying 30% of your income on tax, you end up paying 60%. It is possible. On the other hand, there are also countries that have no taxes at all. So then you pay absolutely nothing. The UN is there to create a more equal world. And so that's what this convention is about, is how do we make our tax world financially more equal? So if I want to be in one country or in another country, if my company is going to be in multiple countries, let's simplify, let's make it easy, and let's equalize the spaces so that we're paying taxes, but we're paying taxes spread across. But we're still, as companies, able to take home the same or similar amounts of profit. And so equality is the cornerstone. And this is really a breaking ground treaty, because never in the history of the world has there been debates to this extent of a treaty on international taxation.
And where do things stand following the latest negotiation session? What progress have we seen? What are the major areas of disagreement as well between different member states?
So this is already breaking ground. So this is a great space that we're in. We have many negotiating states in the room. We've been going at it now for over 2 years, and we have a draft. So we have a draft convention, and then we also have draft protocols, two of them. But when you look at the draft convention, we actually have something now to look at. They've moved at an incredible pace, and they are to be commended. The secretariat has been seriously under-supported. They have very few staff members, but they have a draft. And the member states are to be commended because they are in the room. They are debating honestly. And it's in an open forum, which is also really appreciated, because very often treaties are behind closed doors. But here, there are a lot of open conversations and discussions. So there are stakeholders at the back of the room. It's televised on UN TV. So you can actually see these negotiations in real time and you hear the positions of the country. And honestly, if you understand the debates between countries that are happening behind the scenes or in other spaces on trade issues, you actually see the concern, like, where are we going to go with this? And how is this going to help us? And I think that there's this honesty in the space and as open as possible. Many countries are now coming in with pre-prepared statements as well, of course, because now you have a draft. But till now, you also have a lot of negotiators speaking from their point of view in real time, trying to help feed that document and make it better. I think that is incredible.
So are we seeing areas of consensus between member states?
I think there's consensus that there is inequality.
Yeah.
I think there is a challenge sometimes of understanding terminology, like the definition of a royalty versus a tax versus a levy versus a charge. Right. I mean, sometimes we get a little bit lost in that. So determining the characteristics of what is a tax, right, makes it easier. But I think there is a challenge in that understanding with countries that one hasn't been trading with. So if you look at a country that you don't have a business or a balance of payments exchange going on with, then maybe you won't really know what their tax system is. And I think that is one challenge member states have identified is sort of we need more knowledge and information.
Right.
And then that takes me to the secondary challenge is that many of the tax negotiators are from tax authorities, which is great because they know the tax technical, but they're often not lawyers, which means the legal drafting part of it does lose out in how to go through it. But I notice more and more those who are lawyers in the room are now starting to speak also more and more. So I think it will start to balance itself off as we go along.
Yeah.
But I think that the use of language, the subtlety of language sometimes, as a lawyer myself, I think is not quite there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the crafting.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a central issue in these negotiations is how tax or taxing rights are allocated between countries. So, you know, why has the existing international tax system been particularly challenging for developing and low-income countries?
I usually like giving the example of just, I try to simplify because tax can be really complicated, honestly. So sometimes you'll have a tax law in one country and you'll not have a similar tax law in another country. So when you come to corporations, you will have a tax law that says, we're going to pay a certain type of tax, right? But because it's a multinational corporation and we're a branch, we're simply transferring. We're transferring goods that we're manufacturing. So I love this example. You're making a car. The engine could be in one country being fabricated, the hull of the car in another, the wheels in another, right? Yeah. Now, sold separately, they could have some value. But when you physically put it together, that's when they have the selling value, the car that's able to move on the road. So they will transfer these pieces to the one country where they will put it together. And when they transfer to that country, that's when they make the profit. But then they don't allocate a profit to the country that manufactured the wheels or the hull or the engine,
right?
So there it's transferred at cost. Mm-hmm. So some countries have a rule that allows it. Some countries don't have any law that says anything about it. And the word we use is transfer pricing. So if you have a law that allows for the transfer of those goods in that way, then you're not going to pay taxes because you're transferring at cost. Mm-hmm. If you have nothing at all in your books, then it's literally, people like saying the Wild Wild West. You can do whatever you want to do because it's not illegal, because it's not in the law. And so for me, that's where we need to fix. We need to find a way to balance the space. And this is where, for me, the whole inequality conversation starts to come in. And this is, I think it's so important. This is not just about developing countries. The reason this is on the table in the UN is because this is affecting developed countries as well. So manufacturing of a car, often takes place in global north countries. Mm-hmm. So even the example I'm giving you, it's about how to tax across those spaces.
Yeah.
But the rules that exist right now is a win-lose. You will either 100% tax in the country where the company is headquartered, and I'm really simplifying, or you will 100% tax in the country where you're manufacturing those bits, mm-hmm. or where you're mining, or where you're farming, right? For example. So what this treaty, I hope, will try and achieve is how do we smoothen that space so that nobody is losing out and everybody wins their fair share of revenue. So we wait and see.
Yeah. So for a developing country, if these negotiations are successful, how does their situation change for the positive?
So they should hopefully be able to get a better share of tax revenue. I mean, every country in a different economic level as we grow upwards should be able to get their fair share. Now, that does mean that even within smaller groups of countries, the bigger economy will lose out to the smaller economies at each layer level. So even if you're looking at a middle income country surrounded by low income or a high income country surrounded by middle income, you should be able to see a shift in some kind of revenue base as a result of it. That, I think, is the challenge. I think the bigger economies in each of those groups of countries where there is trade taking place are facing that conversation.
So are you seeing resistance from the bigger economies towards this kind of balancing effects across these supply chains that you were referring to?
Yeah, well, I think the fact that they're even at the table means that they are open to it, for sure. But yes, I do see resistance. I do see concern. We are in a global economic crisis. Mm. So understandably, we are seeing resistance. But there's also been something else behind the scenes, which has been lack of access to information in tax disputes.
Right.
So this lack of access to information also means that I hear arguments like, you know, you're pushing for something where you think there is revenue, but it's not that much. And my argument back is usually, well, that's why we need access to the information, so that when you get the access to the information, you will see the truth of the matter. So there is that debate also taking place at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one of the biggest challenges is the obfuscation of who the human being is that owns a company right at the bottom layer, which is called beneficial ownership. I mean, these kind of rules and regulations really need to be in place. We need to show who is the person making the profit. Because at the end of the day, governments across the world will pick a tax target. And they will go to their revenue authorities or their tax offices, and they will say, we want you to collect $1 trillion this year. Now, it is then left to that revenue team to collect. And if they don't get it from income tax, which is what this treaty is really all about, then they're going to look for it from VAT. And VAT affects poor people, middle-class people, and wealthy people differently because it's about how much you consume.
Right.
And poor people, food-wise, will consume the same amount as everybody else. Now, not all countries have taxes on VATs, but developing countries do very often. So that means your food prices are going to go up. And it's really important that we don't do that to people. I think people who are low-income earners, who are unemployed, we need to make sure we're not taxing them. We need to be supporting them so they can grow economically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we'll tax them. I'd be happy to tax them once they get wealthier, but not when they're not,
right?
So we need to understand and appreciate that inequality in the space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's pivot over to another major focus of your research, which is sovereign debt. So, we hear the term fiscal space frequently in international development discussions. But what does fiscal space actually mean for a low-income country? And why does taxation matter so much to creating it?
So fiscal space can mean different things depending on the context. But when it comes to usually debt, fiscal space is usually referring to the ability of a country to, say, take on more debt. Do we have the space? Do we have room to take on more debt? But how do we translate that into getting more revenue, spending more? The best way I can explain it is where's the room to play for a government of the day to get more money in order to build big infrastructure projects and then have that project actually be self-sustainable. And that's really where the biggest dilemma lies, because what we see in the data is that, say a country will get a debt today. It takes 5 or 8 years sometimes to finish building a big project, sometimes longer. I mean, building a big dam might take even 10 or 15 years, right? But repayment schedules with sovereign lenders comes after 5 years. So like the Bretton Woods, like IMF or World Bank. So you're already starting to pay off your interest rate on something you haven't started earning any kind of revenue on. And then your development project isn't intended to produce a profit. It's a development project. It's intended to jumpstart your economy, get more energy, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So there isn't a direct collection the government is doing in the first 5 to 10 years very often. But your interest rate kicks in within five to six years.
Right.
And 10 years later, you're paying off the full debt, or 15 years later, you're paying off the full debt. And sometimes, like when COVID hit, for example, now when we're in an economic downturn, when prices change, then suddenly you may not have even finished the project. So countries then start tapping into tax. But that project that you thought was going to jumpstart your economy hasn't even finished yet. So there's no jumpstart yet. So you're sitting and looking at the same economy, and you're now expecting it to produce tax revenue to pay the debt. Because if you don't pay it off, then you get downranked by the credit rating agencies. They declare you junk status, your currency loses value, and then suddenly you can't even finish the project because it becomes that much more expensive. And this is a cycle. This is a cycle happening in many developing countries across the world. And then you have the added problem of countries often change government after 5 to 7 years. So in that life cycle of that project, which is right. In debt, you have new leadership who are coming in, have different priorities, things stop,
right.
Things start. So you see, it's getting more complicated. And so that fiscal space is extremely unstable. It is not as elastic as it is portrayed to be, like almost like it's something neutral, right? When people talk about fiscal space, it seems like it's something that's just there, but it's not. It's this very volatile space, and it needs to be stabilized. And I think that is a really big challenge. I don't see many countries really able to address, because we don't have a global tax debt treaty the way we have this tax conversation.
Yeah.
Because it was turned down during the financing for development negotiations in Seville. So then that whole conversation starts to pop up again. And it does give me great concern. There's a great... I don't know, Dan seemed to be in my brain today, but there's a great project, I think it was in France, if I'm not mistaken, where they took about 40 years to finish either building the dam or paying off the debt or something, and then 100 years, yes, no, I think it was 40 years to finish building the dam, 100 years to finish paying off the debt,
right?
And now is when their revenue, the power is like almost free.
Yeah.
And it's now. That's happening now. It's a dam that's just been finished. I may be making some mistakes on it, but it's this 40-year to 100-year thing that just blew me away. And I was like, well, if we're talking about a 40-year marker and a 100-year marker for a developed country, then what are we talking about for developing countries, right? So we need to recalibrate with that.
Yeah. And just briefly, I mean, so the framework convention that we're discussing today, in very kind of brief terms, how does that help a developing country in the situation that you just described?
Yeah. So ideally, it should give a developing country not only more revenue within the next couple of years, because, I mean, it still needs to be signed off on and all the rest, but it should also give that developing country better access to information on who the companies are in their country, how much tax they can collect from them and measure. And ideally should help it bring more trade into their countries, because now that you actually see what the real productivity is and what the real revenue is, you can then perhaps attract companies to build value chain in your country and you can understand how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And then also stop taking taxes from the poorer members of your country,
right,
because you are now better able to collect from the bigger economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and this discussion on fiscal space leads to a recent article that you wrote for UNUCPR, Hidden Debts, Missing Assets. And in this article, you make quite a strong argument, compelling argument as well. So you mentioned that the international financial system has become increasingly sophisticated at measuring what countries owe, but it remains less effective at recognizing what countries own. So what are these missing assets and why aren't they adequately reflected in the way we assess a country's economic position?
It's kind of one of my favorite blogs right now, so I'm glad we're talking about it. And it was a fun piece to write, I have to say, because, you know, I travel like a lot,
yeah,
in and out of my continent. And the one thing that always strikes me is how much I miss my sunshine. And I think that's sort of where this conversation started in my head, because when you buy a solar panel, right,
mm-hmm,
then you're going to buy a poorer quality, relatively, solar panel in a country that has better sunshine.
Right.
And then if you're in a country that has less sunshine, then you're going to have to buy a more high value one, because then you have to trap the fewer rays of sunshine that you're there. This is my layman sort of understanding,
yeah, yeah,
of solar power,
sure,
right? And then I would think the same for wind. And I would think the same for wave energy. And this is something I started to see. So I think Chile has the strongest sunshine in the world in the Atacama Desert. And they're building massive solar panels there right now to capture that as energy. But are we going to see it in their budget? Do we get to see it as an asset the way we're going to see how much mineral they have, like how much oil a country has or how much,
mm-hmm,
gold a country has? And you're not going to see that. And then Kenya, which is my home country, has the fastest wind speeds in the world in around Lake Turkana. Mm-hmm. And we've put up wind vanes. So
yeah,
this also became a little bit personal for me, because I was like, hold on a minute, fastest winds, like, we need to cash in on this. How are we cashing in on this? And very often when you talk about debt or taxes, then people want to put things into monetary value. And we live in a world where you can measure it. You can measure the wind power, the wave energy, right? And you can, I think waves, the strongest currents are of the Florida coastline.
Okay.
So it's not just a developing country asset, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly it's a developed country asset as well. So where is that in the budget? And it doesn't show. So for me, that was the first trigger into this conversation. The second thing that really triggered me was aging populations. And I am going to different countries, and you are starting to see that in some countries, there is a negative growth rate, which means that they're heavy on social spending on pensions and on healthcare for obvious reasons. As we get older, we're not so well anymore. At the same time, you see other parts of the world, including Africa, for example, with massive youth bulge. So you have youth and you have energy and you have ability to work. And what is the asset value of that, right? Of that economically productive unit? And somebody could argue that AI may replace that, but not for everything. So you're going to need human beings for quite a while as economically productive people. How do we put that into the national budget?
So if these assets are measured, I mean, what are the consequences for, let's focus on developing countries.
Yes.
What are the consequences for developing countries if those assets are measured?
Okay. So say we take on a debt. And like I said, you usually pay a debt after 15 years, right? Or 20 years. So 10 years from now, all those young people who are 15-year-olds will be 25-year-olds.
Right.
And if they're healthy, happy, active, which is why I love human rights,
mm-hmm,
and well-educated 25-year-olds, they become wonderful, economically productive human beings, earning a salary, paying a tax. Now, if you don't have that youth bulge, then you don't have that asset value that is going to be the ones producing and paying off. And so your debt can get paid off because, like I said earlier, we're taking on debt, but we're not even ready to, it's not even producing its own generation of profit and revenue, which means that you're going to look at tax. So suddenly your youth bulge is going to be what saves you because you signed on a bad agreement on debt and there was an economic crisis and you haven't yet finished building the project. So that they are your fail-safe. So if they're your fail-safe, what's the value add for the fail-safe? And how do we honestly look at them and say, you guys are protecting us and we need to have good value for you? And I think that this is important. And then, of course, AI and the internet is also its own productivity. So there are several places in the world where they say there are young people who are more tech-savvy and are really on the system and are innovating. That is also an asset. So how do we value that?
Right.
So, and then I can break that down even further. If you're producing more doctors than others, if you're producing more healthcare professionals than others, then the country without has less of an asset and you have more of an asset. Now, these are never figured into any of the credit ratings. These are never figured into what is the asset of a country.
I see. Okay.
And so this country is going to go and negotiate debt and say, we want $1 billion to build a dam, hypothetically, right? And then they're going to say, okay, but what do you have? And they're going to say, we have an oil field.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not going to say, we have a million young people who are going to turn 25 next year, and we have manpower.
Right.
These conversations don't figure in that space.
So you're saying if these assets are measured, then it actually increases the fiscal space that developing countries have.
Yes, and it recategorizes them. They're not as developing as we think they are.
Yeah.
Because then you have to pitch them up against the country with a negative birth rate, with fewer people born, with less labor force,
right,
that is relying on migrants from other countries to build their face. And we know many countries like that as well. So yeah, so shouldn't that country also be pitched lower? And then shouldn't this other country be pitched higher?
Right.
Like, who's having the conversation about the indicators and the measures that rank countries on their assets?
And then I guess, I mean, if, you know, the assets are measured, the, you know, the borrowing costs are going to be favorable towards developing countries.
And the interest rate goes down.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So how does this relate back to the negotiations that we've been following over the last 2 weeks with the Framework Convention?
So it becomes crucial because we are debating on corporate income tax mainly, but also high net worth individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So who are those, right? And if we are able to give a country a higher asset base, and it has less interest rates to worry about in paying off its debt, we also have less need for tax as backup.
Right.
So that whole fiscal system often needs to be looked at as a whole. So we look at reducing ODA globally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we look at increasing of debts being taken across the world. And then from 5 years to 8 years from now, then we're going to, if those projects don't work out, we look at higher collection of taxes. But if we look at proper collection of taxes from now, right? We look at proper ranking of the asset base of a country,
mm-hmm.
then the interest rate is less, right? Then there's now more fiscal space.
Yeah.
So suddenly the pressure gets alleviated. But this is why I come into this space from the perspective of fiscal law and policy. I don't come into it as a tax specialist or a debt specialist. I like to look at the whole system as a whole because you have to balance these pieces all the time.
Yeah. So I want to, you know, just step back and look at the bigger picture beyond the Framework Convention negotiations. So we've now got major international discussions taking place around taxation, sovereign debt, development finance, and also there's a intergovernmental process now on beyond GDP. Do you see these as separate reform processes? Or are they becoming parts of the same conversation, as it were, about how economic value is measured and distributed internationally?
So, unfortunately, they are running separately.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, they are. There's very little conversation about beyond GDP, for example. In fact, there's none in the room for the tax negotiations. But they have to work together, because if they don't, then what are we? What is the Rubik's Cube looking like, right? Like, how are we balancing the space? And so I think that, and this is, again, why I like the fiscal approach into the space, because all the debates and the discussions happening in tax are on issues around tax in, for example, GDP, right? But if we have the conversations of beyond GDP, but we also have the multi-vulnerability index that was developed by the SIDS and the countries under special circumstances, right? So we have these alternative measures, and these alternative measures are very valuable. So how do we make sure we're using the right measure for everybody? Because here's the other thing. If we use GDP, which is economic productivity, but we don't use that recognition of special circumstances, which would come out in the multi-vulnerability index, for example, then how will we resolve one of the key issues in the terms of reference, which is inequality? So how do we measure that inequality? And if we only measure inequality by economic growth, then we already have so much data talking about the fact that, you know, if everybody consumed the same amount as some of the most highly consuming societies in the world right now, we would finish the assets of the world, I think, in 21 times in 1 year. That's what data is showing.
Right.
So we clearly have to figure this out. It's not happening in the same space. It does need to.
Atiya, on that note, let's finish there. Thank you very much for giving up some of your time to speak to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The negotiations over a UN Framework Convention on International Tax Cooperation will continue through 2027. But as we've heard today, the debate is about much more than tax. It raises fundamental questions about who sets the rules of the international financial system, where economic value is recognized and taxed, and whether developing countries have the fiscal space they need to invest in their own futures. Thank you, and until next time.